Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum, the show that's got all your European science and technology news. I'm Zulfikar Abani in Bonn. Coming up, Britain's games industry bouncing off the walls with excitement over its new tax break.
It was received with ecstasy by myself and is received with great enthusiasm by the vast majority of the UK games industry. We're very excited about it.
Also on the programme, the perils of Wii and what to do with it, dealing with Europe's e-waste. And all you need to know about DW's blog awards, the Bobs. That's right here on Spectrum. But first, it's not always easy to make the link between a set of bones that are millions of years old and the way we walk today. But a group of paleoanthropologists in Ethiopia, led by Yohannes Haile Selassie of the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, say they've found a 3.4 million year old fossil foot that could expand our understanding of hominids, that species more closely related to humans than chimpanzees. That could in turn tell us more about ourselves. While the Ethiopian find, known as the Bertelli foot, is the first of its kind since the landmark Lucy skeleton was discovered in the 1970s. But there's a major difference. While it's thought that Lucy was an upright walking species, so very much like us, it's thought that the Bertelli foot belonged to a species that lived later and still swung from the trees. Some say it's settled a dispute over whether there was only a single line of hominids, changing the way scientists think about our evolution. But has it? To find out, I spoke to Professor Richard Leakey. Aside from his own merits as a paleoanthologist, Professor Leakey's mother, Mary, worked on Lucy. I asked Professor Leakey whether he agrees that the dispute is now finally over.
Well, I'd have to say, I think the discovery of the Bertelli foot is extremely important. I think whether there was only one hominid at this age was settled, in my judgment, about 40 years ago, but there's been some recalcitrance on some people's part. But absolutely, yes. There were not one or two, there were probably three or four. And the group in Ethiopia are finally beginning to find their own evidence. But the question I would have to pose, with a foot like that, are we really saying it's a hominid? Surely this is an ape.
You're pointing to some of the indications there that because the Lucy skeleton, which your family was involved in finding in the 70s, was an upright walking skeleton. That's what was thought. And this find, the indications are that the species climbed trees and grassed limbs and that sort of a thing.
Well, the discovery in Ethiopia of Lucy confirmed an upright hominid at whatever it was, 2.9 million years. Mm. The discovery of Australopithecus afarensis in Tanzania at Laetoli, which was both bones and also well-preserved footprints, established upright posture for at least the Tanzanian examples of Australopithecus afarensis. I think this foot that they have just found at 3.4 or 3.5 goes along with other evidence that there were upright hominids. And this is the first non-human foot, I think, that has been found. And I think, as they say in the Nature paper, this has a memory of something that was called Ramidus that Tim White discovered. I think it's hugely important. I just query whether it settles the hominid story or it finally gives us evidence of a lineage of apes that were not necessarily bipedal, but were in the trees, and we've now got fossils that go back to 3.5 million years, all the way back to 4. That's hugely important.
So what would it take, in your view, to settle this so-called dispute? What more evidence?
I think it's been settled long ago. There have been fossils in East Africa that Professor White and some of his colleagues have never accepted, but they mentioned it in the paper. There's Kenyanthropus Platyops, which is clearly not Australopithecus afarensis, at the same age as afarensis. There are other fossils that have been found older, going back to 4.1, 4.2 million years. Australopithecus anamensis, at 4.1, where we've got perfectly good leg bones, and that was upright. So I don't think there's really been any question about there being only one hominid at 3.5 million years, although some people have persisted to insist that there was evidence for only one. In Kenya and in another group, if you like, the East African group rather than the Ethiopian group, we've always maintained the presence of at least two, if not more, species between 3 and 4 million years.
So just explain, for non-experts, like myself, of course, what is the significance?
Well, the significance for scientists, I think, is that you've got evidence at 3.4 million years in the Butele Foot of something that isn't hominid, but relates to something that has been called a hominid, but that some of us doubted, at 4 million years. So you've now got a partially ground-living, non-human ancestor living alongside things like Lucy and Kenyanthropus that were clearly ground-living with upright posture. So you've got at least three different ancient remains of a higher ape, two more like us, one a little different from us in that it didn't have the foot that enabled it to walk as we do.
But what I suppose what I'm trying to understand is why is there this insistence of new evidence? How would it change our understanding of our evolution and who we are today?
In a popular sense, I think it confirms what's been said for a long time, but in a popular sense it's also important because it's the first time we've got apes on the eastern side of the Rift Valley in Africa at a stage in evolution that goes back to 3.5 million years. This is hugely important for our understanding of what was going on then.
Paleontologist Professor Richard Leakey speaking to me there on the line from Kenya. And now it's time for Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The video games industry received a vital boost in Britain's latest budget, with game studios being assured a tax credit from the government. The British Treasury also earmarked a multi-million euro subsidy for the development of super-fast broadband in cities. The government says it's all part of efforts to create a level playing field with sci-tech industries in other countries. Robin Powell takes a look at the apparently tech-friendly budget.
The headlines after this year's budget made for uncomfortable reading for the British Chancellor, George Osborne. He was accused of taking money from the pockets of pensioners while giving tax breaks to the wealthy. He was lampooned for putting a sales tax on hot food. Others, however, were delighted by the Chancellor's plans. Britain's video games industry, for one, will receive a tax credit from next year, along with the animation and high-end television sectors. Richard Wilson, CEO of the video games trade body Tiger, told me it was just the news he'd been waiting for.
It was received with ecstasy by myself and delight by all of Tiger's members, and is received with great enthusiasm by the vast majority of the UK games industry. We're very excited about it because Tiger has been the only trade association that has consistently campaigned for a games tax relief over the last 4 years.
So why does a billion euro industry with a proven track record of success here need tax relief? Wilson says it's firstly about creating a level playing field with other countries, in particular Canada, that have injected cash into their local games industry. Secondly, he argued, it's about helping the UK economy as a whole.
95% of studios in the UK export. The average studio generates 45% of their turnover through exports. So it's exactly the kind of industry that the UK government should be encouraging and supporting as part of a process of rebalancing the economy away from financial services towards export-led growth and investment.
However, there's no money on the table yet. The size of the tax credit won't be fixed until after a consultation process, and all such legislation has to be approved by the European Commission. Ollie Hyatt from the lobby group Animation UK is confident that it will go through.
You can only have so much state aid in one country, so you have to pass it through Europe to check you're not abusing the state aid rules. The government think it will be relatively simple because there's massive precedent set for people getting state aid.
Another key part of the Chancellor's plans to boost the UK economy is a 120 million euro subsidy for superfast, in other words, fibre optic, broadband. The money will be divided among 10 so-called super-connected cities, including London, Manchester, Edinburgh and Belfast. A further €60 million has been earmarked for developing broadband in smaller towns. The head of policy and research at Newcastle City Council in Northern England, Phil Hunter, said the money was a huge opportunity for his city.
This means that we'll have amongst the fastest broadband speeds of any major city in Europe. And having that ability to transfer massive amounts of data in the blink of an eye will help our businesses reach new markets and products, as well as attracting new companies to come and invest in the city.
Leeds bid jointly for the money with the neighbouring city of Bradford. The Leeds councillor in charge of city development, Richard Lewis, says the broadband upgrade will be targeted at particular areas.
The two city centres and the area that connects them, and it extends beyond that into our enterprise zone. So it's very much a kind of geographical area, but a geographical area that's got a lot of small businesses and medium-sized businesses operating within it, and a lot of residents as well.
The money for superfast broadband means this year's budget handed a double boost to the video games industry. Jason Kingsley is the head of Oxford-based gaming company Rebellion, the firm behind the Alien vs Predator games franchise. He explains that companies like his rely increasingly on the internet for distribution.
The fatter the pipe, the faster we can deliver content to people, the less friction gets in the way. They don't have to wait for a movie to download, they don't have to wait for a game to download. So yes, that really helps.
Experts say that the video games tax relief and broadband upgrade will have to be implemented quickly to make a difference. After all, internet speeds are increasing around the world, with or without subsidies, and other countries will surely want to seize back the initiative in the lucrative global video games market. Robin Powell for DW, London.
Don't forget, you can always get Digital Europe as a podcast, and all it takes is a simple search for DW Digital Europe. You're listening to Spectrum on DW. I'm Zulfikar Abani.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. I'm in his favorite sundress, watching me get undressed, take that body downtown. I say you're the bestest, leaning for a big kiss, put his favorite perfume on, go play a video game. It's you, it's you, it's all for you, everything I do, I tell you all the time.
It's one of the most controversial and exciting fields of research, synthetic biology. Its goal is to create nothing less than entirely new forms of life, organisms created by scientists in labs for a specific purpose. Sven Panker is one of the world's leading synthetic biologists, and Lydia Heller went to Panker's lab in Basel, Switzerland, to talk to him about the ins and outs of synthetic biology and ask why it helps to be a little naive when doing research. Sean Sinico has the report.
Sven Panker studies synthetic biology. It's a relatively new field of science that looks at the interconnected worlds of molecular biology, genetics, biotechnology, and engineering.
Systematic biology plants animals, all those things. That's not what we're doing at all. We're making bacteria. It really doesn't have anything to do with natural research.
The 42-year-old is among Europe's most well-known synthetic biologists. He's been examining cells, genes, proteins, enzymes, and their properties and characteristics for well over 10 years. Now he's a professor for biochemical engineering at the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology in Zurich. And for the last 3 years, he's also been the head of the Bioprocess Laboratory at the Biosystems Department in Basel. At Tinguely Fountain in Basel, Panke points to the iron parts spinning as spraying water keeps them in motion. Wheels, posts, and pipes, they all used to be stage props, but here they serve as sculptures. They've been designed and constructed to serve in new conditions.
It's
similar to what we're trying to do with cells. We understand the individual element. What we'd like to be able to say is how a certain element would act and react under certain conditions. My vision is to have biological systems, cells, that are so simple and components that are so well understood that I can put them together and create a new system that does exactly what I want and nothing else.
Und das neue System macht genau das, was ich will und nichts anderes.
If Panke and his colleagues are successful, they'll create new forms of life, cells and bacteria whose genetic information was programmed by a computer to have exactly the properties the scientists want. And the life forms will all be made from standardized components that have been synthetically manufactured. Panka says it's taking an engineer's look at the complexity of life that fascinates him. That, and the possibly naive or maybe even pretentious conviction that life can really be created by a set of synthetic building blocks.
We look at things more playfully. We tell students, here's a bunch of building blocks, see if you come up with something interesting. It's possible to take a more hands-on approach to things, and people seem to enjoy it more. There's no one standing around saying, it's up to you guys to work on this cancer gene. It's more like putting a box of Legos on the floor and saying, get started.
Man stellt ihn einfach so eine kleine Lego-Kiste vor die Füße und sagt, macht mal.
That's one of the main reasons why synthetic biology is so successful, and Panka says the field's potential is far from exhausted. Theoretically, if you have the right set of biosystems, it's possible to create nearly any substance. Reality, however, is not quite as advanced.
Was wir als erstes sehen werden, sind chemische Moleküle für die.
The first thing we'll see are chemical molecules. They'll be for the pharmaceutical industry, or chemical companies, or the energy sector. Then there will be other ideas, biological systems that can make stones or bones. Materials like steel and plastic could be completely replaced in the future. The boldest vision is a house that grows out of a tree, because the tree has been programmed to create walls the way a person wants.
It's no secret that Panka doesn't always like to talk about what synthetic biology could achieve. Many of the ideas could only be made into reality when synthetically altered organisms are used in experiments outside of the laboratory. And a look at the debate that continues to surround the use of genetically modified foods makes it clear that a lot of people still have serious reservations.
There have been a lot of people from all sides involved in an intense, not to say acrimonious, debate in Germany. And I'd rather not take part in that debate. I'm a part of this society, and I don't want to have the feeling that I'm leading to the death of society. That's not my intention.
Instead, Panka says he wants a more measured approach to the subject that could alter the way we think about life.
Personally, I don't think that synthetic biology poses any particularly great dangers. I assume the cells that we're making would not be able to survive outside the laboratory. They've been made in reactors under a controlled temperature and controlled nutrient supply for specific artificial situations. But when someone asks, are you 100% sure? Then my answer is, of course, no.
At the international conferences that take up a big chunk of his time, Panka calls on his colleagues to make their work as transparent as possible and to seek out dialogue with the public.
We have to make it clear that there might be some risk, but it also has to be clear that there is a risk to neglecting research. You're eliminating whatever good could come of the work if you don't do it.
The most convincing argument for taking a calm and collected approach to synthetic biology, Panka laughs, is probably a simple one. The research is still in the very beginning stages. Of 100 experiments, one is successful.
That means whenever something actually works, you're very, very excited about it. At least that's how it goes for me. It's what keeps me motivated for another week or another month before the routine of having more problems than answers sets in again. Research is, fundamentally, a very frustrating undertaking.
Grundsätzlich eine sehr frustrierende Geschichte.
Sven Panka ending that report by Lydia Heller and Sean Sinico. Each year in Europe, millions of tons of electric and electronic devices and appliances end up in landfill. That is, of course, if they're not illegally shipped to poor countries and dumped just there. The European Union Commission is trying to put a stop to the dumping of what they call waste of electronic and electric equipment. And member countries are trying to come up with a way to get the waste properly collected and recycled. Megan Williams has this report from Rome.
Refrigerators, TV sets, computers, cell phones, light bulbs, and batteries. All items that get collected and sorted in the electronic recycling center here on the outskirts of Rome. Each year, the average household in Europe throws out about 16 kilograms of electronic waste. Waste with highly polluting components and metals that needs to be separated from other garbage for proper disposal and recycling. Since 2002, the EU has set a goal of getting European countries to collect a third of all electronic waste they produce, a fairly low target. Now the EU wants to up the ante to 85% in the next 4 years. But many countries are resisting, insisting they need at least 8 years to meet that target.
We think that in the present circumstances we can't afford waiting 8 years, because this waste, electronic waste, is a valuable resource.
Director General of Environment for the European Commission, Karel Falkenberg, is spearheading the push for proper waste collection, not just to cut back on pollution, but because he says resources are getting scarce.
We all need these resources. We're running out of resources. On the world market, we see that prices are rising regularly. We have effective problems in accessing some of the key metals that we need for our modern products.
Such as computer and IT equipment. Italy is one of the countries trying to catch up. A couple of years ago, it collected just 2 kilos of electronics per household, though it's doubled that to 4 kilos this year. Still, that's only a quarter of what gets thrown out each year by Italians, and a far cry from the EU goal of 85%. Until recently, it was taxpayers who picked up the bill for dealing with sorting and recycling appliances. But Danilo Bonato, president of the Italian Electronic Waste Clearinghouse, says with the EU's policy of making producers responsible for all the lifetime costs of their products, the onus has shifted.
Europe is saying, if you are a producer, a manufacturer, you are selling a product, it's your responsibility to take care of the waste, to not only to pay, but you also have to organize a system to take back your products at the end of life and to recycle it.
The cost of properly disposing of electronics is now factored into the cost of the product. In some countries, people even see on their bills for electronic goods exactly how much they're paying for the collection. Falkenberg says it's the most effective way to inform consumers just how costly waste collection can be. He says the pressure has to remain on Italy and other countries to get with the program.
We know by now that when we separately collect waste, we can usefully recycle it. 1 ton of separately collected electronic waste produces 150 grams of gold today. But if I go into an old landfill, I'm trying to look for those 150 grams, I won't find them, at least not on an economic basis.
Even more reason, says Falkenberg, to push for recycling of our electronics.
Megan Williams reporting there from Rome. Now, if you're a blogger or you follow blogs, you'll need to know this. Of course, some people like to say that blogs are just another form of electronic waste, but not DW. In fact, DW's annual blog awards, the BOBs, have just kicked off and voting is underway. Jesse Wingard has more, but be warned, a report begins with the sound of a very deep male voice, a blogger no less, on his love of Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat.
In all, his writing style is quick and fluid, making The Cat in the Hat impossible to put down. While this novel is 61 pages in length, and one can read it in 5 minutes or less.
The Deutsche Welle International Blog Awards, the BOBs, pays tribute to websites in 11 languages championing the exchange of ideas and freedom of expression. The annual awards were launched in 2004, at a time when blogs were just establishing themselves in the internet world. The BOBs project manager, Gabriel Gonzalez, says these awards contribute to upholding human rights around the world.
We want to reward people who are doing an incredible effort to bring social good to their societies, who support and fight for freedom of speech. The aim and the objective of our website to open a window to the users and so that they can discover all these wonderful things and wonderful efforts by persons or groups.
So what's your favourite blog amongst this year's nominees?
No. That's not fair. I won't tell you my favourite. I always have some favourites and I think like, wow, I'm very impressed by this one or that one. But at the end, it's always the jury who decides.
Do you know one that certainly took my eye? It's from a Brazilian blogger and he's trying to convince people to pee in the shower to try and save water. So he estimates that if a person avoided flushing the toilet just one time a day by urinating when taking a shower, it would save up to 12 litres of water, which over the course of the year he added up would be 4,000 litres of water. So I think that's a very good social initiative.
It's great. It's really, you don't have to understand Portuguese to see this website, enjoy this graphics, their animations and everything. But I'm really also very curious to see then in the jury session how the Brazilian jury member will explain this to the, let's say, Chinese, remember, because I think in Asia they have some different ideas and concepts about what to do or not to do in your bathroom. So I don't know. But it's a serious issue, actually.
Now, you've mentioned there that the jury will decide the winner. But can the general public, our Deutsche Welle listeners, also play a hand in who takes out the prizes at this year's Blog Awards?
Sure. There's this online voting right now going on. And for weeks, every user can come to the website and choose and examine and control and see, visit all the sites and decide who is his personal favorite and choose the public winner.
This year, 187 blogs were nominated in 17 categories. One of the blogs in the hot seat to take out the best blog in the English category is Theron Humphrey, an American and blogger of the page This Wild Idea.
I wanted to tell and meet everyday folks, ordinary people, because I honestly felt like one of them. I feel like an everyday person. And what would it look like if I traversed all 50 of the United States and met one person a day, every day, for an entire year to create this huge portrait of the United States in 2012 is like? And that passion came from my grandfather. There was only one photograph of him when he was in his 20s. There was this one image of him in front of his car. And I always like wanted to know what was around him. Like, what if the person who took the photo just did a 180 and took another photo just to create more context of his life? And then I was like, what did my granddad sound like when he was 25? Like, what was the tone in his voice and what was he doing in life and what did he love? So essentially, I'm just going around America and meeting people and trying to create this archive to answer that question for other people. But I think the most compelling part about it is the audio and combining a still image with short audio clips of just the person saying their name is really powerful. And in 30 and 40 and 50 years, when these people have passed, there's going to be this, I think, really beautiful, like, cohesive record of who they were.
Who would have to be the most fascinating person you've met across your journey across the states?
I'm going to have to say Patrick Millard. And the reason why I say him is because 2 weeks after I met him, he passed away. So, like, I was the last person to photograph him. I have audio of his voice. And you can't go meet him. You can't go shake his hand again. And the cool thing that came from that, or the beautiful thing that came from it, his mom sent me a message and, like, thanked me for meeting her son and photographing him. And then when I was in Michigan, where she lives, I went out there and photographed her, and she told me more stories about him and his childhood. So that was like one little connection that was made because of this project. And I think that was one of the most fascinating and obviously sad, too, moments of the project.
Now, when does this trip, your mammoth trip across the states, actually wrap up?
I started on August 1st of 2011, and it'll go till August 1st, 2012. And, you know, like before that, like, I had a corporate job in a photo studio. I was shooting product photography. You know, one day I just woke up and wanted to live a different story. And that with visiting my grandfather in North Carolina, and upon returning to Idaho, he had passed away. So when you're back in the studio shooting a handbag and your grandfather just passed away and you took some portraits of him, you start to question life. You're like, why am I shooting a handbag? Like, why does this piece of product even need to exist in the world?
To keep up to date with the Bob Awards, make sure you head to thebobs.com.
Jesse Wingard there. And that's just about all from Spectrum for now. Don't forget, of course, you can check out the page always at dw.de. And, of course, you can follow us on Twitter, if you like, at dw_SciTech. Well, until next time, on behalf of the whole Spectrum team and studio tech Thomas Schmidt, I'm Zulfikar Ebani saying thanks for listening and bye for now.